Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I was just telling him how handsome he looks in his picture. And he says, ah, don't worry, it's a picture, it's a camera. He was doing what Glenn Rader called one of the cognitive distortions of minimizing a positive and turning it into a negative.
You've come so far, Joe, in your recovery and your personal journey. So why do you minimize the compliment after all that?
Oh, it's a daily program, right?
Yeah.
I have to emotionally regulate all of the time. It's like being on a surfboard, right? You don't stop surfing.
That's right.
You know?
I am so stoked today because Joe and Alan are together in the same frame. This is an audio-only podcast, yeah. But I'm seeing it right now. Yeah, and Tom's here too, and they're broadcasting from the ICSA conference in Orlando, International Conference of Secular AA. And let's just start by them giving us their update and telling us a little bit about some of the ground covered in their expedition over there.
I want to talk about, this person gave a presentation on we're not all egomaniacs, but Patrick is. No, I didn't say that. I said, we're not all egomaniacs, but I think it would be good to pick up that theme, because what she talked about was how unintentionally that the program can shame people, make them feel bad about themselves, or present things in a way. And I think it might be a good idea to talk about how we can deal with that from an emotional sobriety perspective on what happens when someone sends you a message that can be damaging and painful and shaming.
I've been caught saying things that, like saying absolutes. I remember saying in a meeting, well, it's never too early to do an inventory. And then someone with trauma after the meeting
said,
they relapsed for 3 years, they didn't have a trauma informed sponsor and they opened up a can of worms. Right. And why would I ever say never or ever? Right. You know, that's like, how would I know? We had the great joy of speaking back to back.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, like it was amazing.
And yeah, it was funny standing that way back to back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Tom Rutledge move right there. Did you guys see it?
There's some dance moves you could do from that position that are really good. I'll show them to you while we're together. Yeah.
I spoke and Joe came on and gave his and shared right after I did.
Yeah, and there's an energy. 10 years ago was the first International Conference of Secular AA. It was called the We Agnostics and Freethinkers AA Conference. And that year they had a meeting after the meeting and said, hey, I'm an atheist. I'm not an agnostic. Why am I not included? Okay, we'll call it the We Agnostics and Atheists and Freethinkers AA Convention. Hey, I'm a humanist. So we just decided we'd use the word secular because that should include, we hope, everybody, because secular means neither religious nor irreligious. So the whole idea is the format is secular. No praying. People can talk about whatever they want. In fact, we had a great speaker almost confess that, I do believe in a higher power, but I don't care that you don't.
There's just a real inclusive atmosphere in terms of all of you are welcome, no matter what your orientation is. No matter what your thoughts are, no matter what your beliefs are, there's a place for you here. And that's a powerful message, man, because not all of us have felt that in our lives, that there's room for us.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I mentioned that seemed to land well is I was talking about how people feel a lot of pressure talking to someone new. You know, I was speaking specifically about going out on a 12-step call, and like trying to help save somebody's life, right? And, I said, you can't say the wrong thing, right? People don't need to be told. They need to feel heard about that expression. Take the cotton balls out of your ears and stick them in your mouth. I didn't feel included in AA till I was invited to speak and welcomed, right? For who I was and for what I said. We see you, we hear you, we get it, welcome.
We want to hear from you.
Yeah.
How long were you involved, Joe, before you actually got to say your piece, before you spoke?
It would have been at my first meeting for sure, right? Because someone picked me up to take me there and we talked the whole way there. And then there was a speaker meeting and I was introduced to a few people and we talked all the way back. Like I felt connected, right? And, I was very young when I got in. So I was probably sober 3 or 4 months where someone was bringing me along to talk to other young people, like doing public information work in, high schools, right? Not near where I went to school. So it'd be nobody who knew me, right? But, you know, there'd be someone who had a little bit more stability in AA and me. And then I started feeling included and part of something. And now all of a sudden my identity's changed from how am I ever going to live sober? That's boring. To I'm part of this, you know, this straight edge club, right? Like we just do it straight edge. We play music sober. We dance sober. We stay up all night long and drink coffee sober, right? It was, you know, it was a new identity from actually getting to, you know, not from listening and observing, but from participating. Yeah. And that's what Alan was talking about, that everyone's encouraged to participate.
How far back, Alan, does your involvement go with ICSA?
I presented on emotional sobriety at their first meeting in San Diego.
10 years ago.
And just to show you how far technology has come, is that we had a room and there was no projector in it. They didn't have a projector back then. I had my laptop with the file on it and I would play it and try to raise the volume enough for everybody to hear it. It was very Spartan. And today we're enjoying a conference in a very nice hotel here at the DoubleTree Hilton. And it's great. There's a lot of great messages. And one of the things I thought would be good to focus on today was this person who wrote a book recently. I don't know her name, maybe Joe does. But the title of the book is not "We Are Not All Egomaniacs."
Beth H. Yeah, so it's look at introverts and AA, or people who are like underdog, not top dog, people who don't identify with the Bill Wilson. We're all egomaniacs. We're all power drivers. And no, we're not.
And she's saying that, and we've acknowledged this before in terms of how we've talked about it, but that when you have low self-esteem, some of the same messages are not relevant and also can be very shaming for a person who's just beginning the program. Like, for example, someone who is putting everybody first all the time has a hard time identifying with being told they're selfish and self-centered.
Yeah.
Someone who's fawning. And we saw that. Remember when we were in London with Dr. Ingrid?
With Ingrid. Matthew,
she talked about, you know, the fawning response. And that's what this woman was talking about, too, is that position is one of putting everybody else first and accommodating everybody else, not trying to control them overtly. Now, I would argue that that's a covert way of showing up and manipulating.
It's trying to control your environment to be
in
safe.
A different way.
Yeah, that's right. Just a different way. But see, it's hard for that person to identify as being selfish because they feel like they've been putting everybody else first their whole life.
Yeah, and they're both faulty coping mechanisms. Yeah.
They're both faulty coping mechanisms. But here's the critical thing. When we are not seen, it creates an injury to our self-esteem, especially the more undifferentiated we are. Let me say that again. When we're not seen, it creates an injury to our self-esteem. In psychoanalytic literature, it's called a narcissistic injury. It creates an injury to our self-esteem if we're undifferentiated. As I become more and more differentiated, meaning as I develop more and more emotional sobriety or emotional maturity, then your limited opinion of me doesn't have as much of an impact. You don't define me. But early on, when people are walking in the room, they're very raw.
Yes.
They're very undeveloped, right? And so this is where these ideas we have, when we try to treat them like one size fits all, doesn't work.
And being very careful about how we speak, like mindful, not falling into our same old verbal, you know, habits, because we were desensitized to some of these things. And it's important to remember, you know, how harsh some of this sounded when I was brand new. Right. And I've, you know, that's so 5 minutes ago. Right. You know, it's hard for me to do. So I try to say it in a way that isn't my, you know, pat story.
Yeah. Well, I can give you a personal example of that. So I came into program, and I think you guys know this, is that I came into program when I was 19 years old, essentially a high school dropout. I did complete the first year, my freshman year of high school, but I essentially never went to school. They just passed me because they wanted to get Berger out of the classroom. So I had no formal education at all from the eighth grade forward, right? And so, you know, as you guys know, I got so turned on to recovery back then, right? When I heard Tom share his story and I saw the freedom in him, you know, there was a part of me that says, man, if I could have that, life could work. That was the first thing that really excited me and created an interest in myself and in my experience and a curiosity that was shut down, that I desensitized myself to. The next thing that happened was helping other people, right? Then I had 6 days clean. They invited me to become a counselor. So today, I don't think I can get a job at 60 days.
But those were the times. Talking about doing public information when I was 2.5 months sober. You know, I'm like 16 years old. I'm perfect to go in front of the kids, right? And when our home group does hospitals and institutions, we go into a detox. I explain that who's the newest here. You know, I don't know if you were told, but you're speaking because nobody wants what I have. Nobody wants to sign up for the multiple decades of sobriety plan, right? All of the people in there would love to
get how am I going to get there. How am I going to detox? Yeah. Right? How am I going to get one day?
Teeth white, eyes white, couple of bucks in their pocket. Nobody's planning or wanting long-term sobriety. So the newest person is going to connect with people better than, you know, someone who's so dry they're a fire hazard.
So then the next thing that happened for me is I decided I wanted to become a clinical psychologist. We got some training for us because all of us were paraprofessionals. That was the term we used for those people that worked in the field that weren't professionals. We worked alongside professionals, but we really didn't have any professionals at the program. It was that program. So we were it. So we were bringing in these clinical psychologists who had doctoral degrees from the University of Hawaii and stuff to train us. And I go, my God, I'd love to be able to do that stuff, right? So at that point, I said to myself, I set a goal. I want to get a PhD in clinical psychology. This was back in 1971, right? So I went to a meeting and I was so excited that I had made this decision and shared it. Now, what do you imagine happened in the meeting? Patrick, this is a test. See if you're listening.
You did not get maybe the enthusiasm or the validation that you were seeking?
I got the opposite. You'll know that. Alcoholics never finish what they start. You know, you're pie in the eye dreaming. You're being grandiose. You know, and essentially, you know, you won't be able to achieve what you want to achieve. Now, that did mean something to me now because I was needing a lot more support, right? Environmental support. Now, thank God I had a sponsor that after that meeting, he says, you listen to me, not them. He said, I know you better than they know you. And I see something in you that I know that you aren't going to give up on this goal. I can see what it means to you. And I know that you are going to take this serious in your life and you're going to pursue it. Now, thank God I had someone that could neutralize that other message. Had I not had that, just think if I didn't have that relationship with my sponsor, Tom, what would have happened? You know, I might have walked out of there and internalized and agreed, because there was a part of me that doubted it too. Trust me, it's not that I knew 100% that I was going to be able to achieve that in my life. That was a daunting enterprise, given I was a high school dropout and wanting to go to get a doctorate in clinical psychology, right? And especially the more I figured out what it means to do that, they became, I could see how big of a mountain that was going to be to climb. But I had the desire, I had the dream, I had the hope that that could become true for me. And if I had those messages we talked about, that we're going to call them toxic messages, diminishing messages, messages that say that you can't be what you think you can be, which too many of us have had in our families. You see, this is where sometimes what's happening is the program is recapitulating the dynamic, the pathology that we experience in our family of origin. If we're around people that are conscious, like Joe might pick that up and help me with it. Or if I was around Joe, I might pick it up and help him with it and at least neutralize that. But I have seen people get put down in meetings and shamed in meetings and not want to come back to the meetings anymore. I remember, and this impressed me because of this topic, because I am a very sensitive person. I do have a lot of empathy. I was at this one meeting and somebody got up and she hadn't been coming to a lot of meetings, and she showed up and was talking about recovery. And the next speaker that got up just reamed her for not going to meetings all the time. And one of the older guys there somebody that had long-term sobriety got up and says, listen, this meeting is not about how many days you attend. It's about what it means to you. We are not here to punch an attendance card. And don't judge. None of us have the right to judge somebody else if they're not showing up to meetings.
Yeah.
If they're here at the meeting today, that's the only thing that's important, not whether they've been coming every day, every week, something like that. So he did exactly what Tom did for me. You see that? That he took what would have been a real toxic message to this person, like, you're doing the program wrong.
Yeah.
Don't you know it's wrong? Yeah. You're not doing it right. You're going to drink again. Yeah. Nobody knows that. She was going to as many meetings as she could go to and probably as many as she needed. And that was fine. But if we go ahead and see, this is where this stuff dovetails so nice with the emotional sobriety. We got to look at what our expectations are that we put on other people and how they're supposed to behave. Thinking if they do it the way I do it, they're doing it right. Really? Just because you think it's that way, is that what's right? It may be. I'm not saying you're not. I'm not saying that sometimes the feedback we get isn't valuable.
No.
But we can't. We've got to be careful. We got to be careful as the person sending out the message, and got to especially careful if you start picking up somebody else's idea and it's toxic to you. You've got to figure out what you can do to protect yourself better from those kinds of messages.
And again, the person who is putting the other person down, when I hear that said in a meeting in a sort of crosstalk situation, one of the great disarming things I love to use, and I borrowed this from another member, is, you know, you may be right because you're conceding nothing, right? But a lot of people go to a lot of meetings and that's very helpful. But I know a single parent mom who's lucky to get to a meeting every couple of weeks, right? Three kids. No support, right? And I know someone else who zooms in but can't always stay on the meeting because their partner has dementia, and they don't always have an hour to themselves, right?
That's such a simple workaround, because it's as we've discussed earlier in the show, we're adding, we're not subtracting to the paradigm.
Yes, and not either or, right? Exactly right.
What do you think, Tom?
Well, I think a lot of what you guys are talking about, it's interesting. I'm thinking from this perspective of our Thursday night meeting. If you go back and listen to our past meetings, you're going to see what you were describing, Alan, in terms of the other side of that stuff, is Roger and I have been balancing out you and Herb the whole damn time. because that's our position. It's like the top dog egomaniac. Okay, but also if you're the guy who thinks you're the worst goddamn thing on the planet, you know, and if you listen, it's one of the things I think is really beautiful about how we've balanced the group of us that have what I call the four old men finally speak. You know, it's like it's everybody's relieved by that. But our particular group really balances in that way, I think. So so I love what you're saying.
Did he just call me old? Is that what he just said?
I did. Said the old man with the gray hair and gray beard.
Well, what I've always liked and what I thought of as soon as you guys started talking about this, about we are not all egomaniacs. Yes. Is the positive reframe around our best thinking got us here. Because whenever I'd heard that in meetings in the past, okay, I'd always experienced that as like, well, you know,
That's how messed up you are. That's how pathological you are. Right.
Who
was it that said? I think we've said it last Thursday. And I can't remember who said it.
You're damn right.
Yeah. My best thinking did get me here.
Got me right here. Look, that's right.
I'm right here right now. And that's what's important. See, that's that thing about how do we interpret these things? You can look at that in two ways because it's not black and white. That subverts, right? And undermines and usurps any kind of confidence we have in ourselves that, you know what, there may be parts of me that I need to listen to more. Not that I need to shut myself down. And Tom, you and I know this to be very true, is that a big part of people's problems is they're listening to the wrong part of themselves.
What I always say is the toxic stuff is always unsolicited. It's like an asshole person. Grab you. But wisdom, whether it be somebody over there or whether it be the wise part of yourself, is will not come in and slap you around with wisdom. And it's really easy for those loud people and those loud voices in your head to just claim authority because they just sound like they have because it's the weirdest thing in the world. But you know, the most negative thoughts we have in our heads, most dangerous voices. This is just fascinating to me. Have never had a crisis of confidence inside somebody like me who has felt so like shit for his whole life, but never once has my should monster said to me, "You're a low down, useless piece of shit, but you know, consider the source." I may not know.
The louder someone is getting and trying to convince other people they're right, the more wrong they really are, right?
If I'm shouting to convince you about being right,
I may not be right on this issue.
Shakespeare said, "He doth protest too much.
That's right.
So, Joe, is there some strain of this that you were expressing earlier in your talk at ICSA? Like, what was some of the content that can you share any with us of what you were bringing to your part of the conference?
Well, I was taking a look at some of the, you know, just new ways of looking at things, right? Like I have superstitions. I did this and this happened, so this caused that, right? Like I see correlation and I assign causality, right? I worked the steps, so it's the steps that got me sober. But maybe not. Maybe it was a supportive group of people that were always there for me. Maybe if I'd done the Eightfold Path instead of the 12 steps, I still would have been sober, right? Maybe I just, there's a... A guy I refer to in my talk, David Bess is his name.
Yeah, that's right.
Studies alcoholics. He looks at all of the different ways of people are getting sober, whether it's 12-step based, whether it's going to a therapist, whether it's, She Recovers or Dharma Recovery or any of these things. And he says, Goya is the universal feature we see in all of that. GOI is an acronym, get off your arse. Just do something and you change the brain chemistry, right? You change your self-image. Everything changes when you get in motion. And especially if you're modeling pro-social behavior, you know, you're doing what the sober group is doing, right? I'm going to do that, right? And so that's why the 12 steps work. because it makes you part of a community. You have a collective language. You're a member now, right? You're part of a family, right? So, but many other things would work too. Positive affirmations, a smart recovery toolkit, the Eightfold Path or Four Noble Truths, all of those things are going to work. And that's what I was talking about. Let's not assume that what got us sober is the best way for everybody. It's just, I'm a sample of recovery. I don't want to be anybody's example.
Joe, what I love about that is I love the fact that you're putting that in the category of superstition, because I'm a big believer that we're all superstitious, whether we admit it or not. And I like that definition of superstition, that we're making these arbitrary assumptions about cause and effect. And the resolution of that is what you're talking about, is just expansion of our respect.
What I was going to say is that the work that everybody on the stream now has been doing in recovery, I just have this image in my head of you're looking at like an arm, right? And the study of, you know, what's the sobriety or the recovery formula? It's like you're looking at like all the different sinews of the arm, like the tendons, the muscles, the bone structure. And you're kind of like looking at that magic trick of like, how did we find recovery, and kind of trying to reverse engineer it to kind of figure out, well, how can we make this better? How do we get somebody from here to there? Because it's not any one thing. It's like a bunch of different things working in tandem.
And even when if we're Venn diagrams, we have so much intersection, but we all are very unique, very different.
And when you survey people about who, like, they've done these life and recovery surveys in the US, in Canada, in Great Britain, and in Australia, you know, list the things that contributed to your sobriety and how important they were to you. And like the average person has six things that they think, you know, I needed them all. You know, I needed my therapist. I needed my meetings, right? I needed a sponsor. I needed my health membership at the gym, right? Who knows which one was the real secret sauce or the key ingredient there, but it's a craft, not a science.
I was going to ask about the language of God. I'm guessing is completely absent from ICSA, right?
That's why I use the word superstition in talking to these people who think they've maybe one-upped, you know, they're in sobriety 2.0 all of a sudden because they've overcome this, you know, idea of a supernatural power that gets you sober, when really, there's no such thing as a non-believer. We all believe something, right? You know, some people kneel at the altar of reason. They find AA too old fashioned, so they start listening to the Stoics. That's pretty funny.
We're looking at you, Tom.
Mm-hmm. That's me. Well, the Stoics are a great example because they always leave open a place for God. They don't. Yeah. They're the perfect group of philosophers who don't give a holy shit whether you believe in God or not.
We all know what like a fundamentalist believer is like, and we've all heard the fundamentalist atheist who thinks that any faith is, you know, unhelpful and a sign of an undeveloped mind. A fundamentalist agnostic says, I don't know, and you don't either.
That's it. That's true.
I started to say I used it in my workshop, but I've actually just done a bit about fundamentalist atheists, because I'm going like, I grew up in West Texas. I grew up with people trying to save my soul, you know, which is very irritating. But the truth is that what I can say is the people I've known through the years who've tried to save my soul are doing it because they care about me. It's like, yeah. I can't figure out what the atheists are trying to save me from. It's like, it's okay. You don't, why are you offended that somebody believes in something? You know, it's a bit of an ego trip.
Oh, we talked about this earlier. The fundamentalist anything is someone who doth protest too much.
Yeah,
they're trying to convince themselves, not.
That's it. My friend Bendel. We used to call him a fundamentalist hippie.
Do you guys watch True Detective, the first one with Matthew McConaughey? I like his form of protesting too much. He's got really into like a kind of philosophical pessimism, but in the end, it was just a reaching out he had a lot of love in his heart, but it had been thwarted. And so he was looking for this pessimistic language to accommodate the pain that he'd suffered. I always think of that character when I think about the very militant pessimist.
That's a subject for a book you should write, is using movies. You know so much about stuff out there in Hollywood, all the movies and stuff. There's so much stuff in there that you could apply to recovery.
That's the language I use to parse things.
A great example is Joseph Campbell. He was doing all this work on the hero's journey, but when he sort of used Star Wars as an example of this, everyone bought in and started seeing it everywhere, right?
That
I'm not capable. I'm no hero, right? And it's the same, the Matrix story with Neo and everybody else. Yeah.
All right. Well, good show today, you guys.
And I'm hoping I can be there in person next year.
2 years from now.
Okay. Well, 2 years from now, I should still be intact, but not going to count my chickens before they're hatched.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.